Our gospel reading continues from last week's. We're in a place called Caesarea Philippi, is the Greek, or Philippi, as we usually pronounce it around here. Caesarea Philippi is a gorgeous place. If you've ever been in the Holy Land, it is not what you think of as the Holy Land. It is forested, it is green, and there is a cliff, and out of the base of the cliff comes this upwelling of beautiful, clear water. It is the source, or one of the sources, but the primary source, of the Jordan River coming right out of the ground. And it is a place, we are told, of human habitation for tens of thousands of years. It is where the ancient biblical city of Don was, and in the Greco-Roman period, it was a temple to the Greek god Pan was there. So we had a long history of various pagan religions centering themselves there. In Jesus' lifetime, Philip, one of Herod the Great's sons, who was the tetrarch of this area, in order to curry favor with Caesar, named this area after, built a brand new spanking city and called it Caesarea Philippi. So both honor to Caesar and to Philip himself. So here's this place of giving honor to an emperor, a little bit of ego by Philip, a long history of civilization and pagan worship, and Jesus asks the disciples a pointed question.
Jesus went with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do the people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." He asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah," and he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him.
Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at the disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan. You are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things."
He called a crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their lives will lose it, and for those who lose their lives in my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when it comes in the glory of the Father with the holy angels." And he said to them, "Truly, I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God has come with power."
6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who was talking with Jesus. And then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make 3 dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice, "This is my Son, the Beloved. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them there anymore, but only Jesus.
so much. True confessions time. On one of those really cold winter evenings last week, my wife Barb and I, we poured some red wine. We sat together on the love seat. We gazed into each other's eyes and talked about life insurance. I know, wild night, right? Life insurance. We talked about life insurance. Because there are some big life changes going on, and we have to make some changes in response. Our son Micah has a grown-up engineering job and will actually be going off our health insurance plan in March. Like, woo-woo. Our daughter Chloe will be graduating from college in 14 months. So Barb and I were discussing canceling our life insurance policies in a year and a half because soon they're not going to need anything if one of us dies. They can go on with their lives, and we thought about maybe putting that money into something really responsible like our retirement accounts. Yeah. Very adult, moving into the very end zone of responsible parenting. But talking about getting rid of our life insurance policy got us thinking about when we decided, 21 or 22 years ago, to get life insurance. When Barb and I decided to become official adults by purchasing life insurance in the first place. We were living in the Adirondacks at the time, and we had to be interviewed by this very cranky insurance lady who had to drive up from Albany, New York, to our little hamlet in the central Adirondacks to decide if we were good risks to sell life insurance to. And it was a humiliating experience. I might have shared this story with you a bunch of years ago. But it went something like this. Very sternly, the Albany, New York life insurance lady asks, and for some reason in my mind, it's that secretary from Monsters, Inc. with the glasses. I don't know why. She's in my head. Do you have any dangerous hobbies or occupations? Do you have any dangerous hobbies or occupations? My mind was racing over the previous 3 years, bicycling through a few too many Latin American countries on the brink of revolution, careening down mountain roads at 50 miles an hour on a tandem bicycle with our new baby hanging out the side of the sidecar, flying every weekend in a fragile little wood and cloth airplane with the local funeral director who had clinical depression, running a truckload of illegal computers bound for Cuban hospitals over the Canadian border. And I thought about all those things and I smiled at her politely and said, no. She wasn't satisfied. Motorcycle riding? No. Scuba diving? Just snorkeling. Bungee jumping? No, but it sounds really cool. Ice or mountain climbing? But lady, it's the Adirondacks. We have to do that just to pick up the mail. Skydiving? Not since high school. Piloting an aircraft? No, but you don't want to know who the pilot is. So she glares over her reading glasses. She says inscrutably. And I'm thinking, oh, geez, we're not going to pass. We're too risky to be grown-ups. We flunked adult. And then she asks, occupations. And I reply, we're both clergy persons. And she says, pastors? Well, that's certainly safe. My emotions went from nervous to defensive in half a second. Like, safe, safe. I knew what she thought of our job description. Sit all week in front of your computer, read boring theology books, pray, churn out polite little sermons, have tea with parishioners, go to potlucks, travel twice a week to Glens Falls Hospital for visits, try to survive a pastor-parish relations committee meeting, but mostly nice and safe, easy to ensure. That's not what I wanted her to think. I wanted her to say, wait, you're pastors? Are you crazy? Full-time paid disciples of Jesus Christ? Are you nuts? That's the most dangerous, radical, extreme occupation you can have. Your boss, Jesus, killed. Your predecessor, Paul, killed. Stephen, killed. Martin Luther King Jr., killed. The Marian old priests and nuns in El Salvador, tortured, mutilated, then killed. Christians in China, persecuted, forced underground. The Christians providing sanctuary to refugees in Arizona, jailed. The protesting clergy sharing communion atop the atomic missile silos out west, sentenced to 20 years for having bad wafers and grape juice. The Berrigan brothers sheltering conscientious objectors, jailed. I wanted her to say, life insurance for disciples of Jesus Christ, denied, too dangerous. But instead she said, pastors? That's certainly safe. And she was more right than I care to admit. Because my discipleship is really pretty safe. I mean, I can point to a few pictures, a couple of newspaper front pages. I can be marching in front of the ICE building in Williston with some of you all. Getting arrested at a pipeline protest in D.C., smiling with rabbis and cantors and pastors and nuns at the Stonewall anniversary march. And those are all great, but neither my life nor my reputation were in danger for any of those. Yes, I have a shoebox full of ugly, ugly letters from the mid-1990s for my support for civil rights and marriage rights for same-sex couples. But the world has moved on since then. I don't get ugly letters anymore. But none of it made life insurance a bad risk for USAA. My ideas, or at least my practice, of denying self and taking up my cross are probably not the same ideas that Jesus had when he told the crowd that's what they needed to do. Losing my life in order to save my soul has simply not been on the docket for me. Because I'm a Methodist pastor in Vermont, my life is not on the line. And I'm not trying to be judgmental here at all, but I imagine most of you are in about the same place that I am with your discipleship in that respect. And then we read the stuff from Mark's gospel today, and it's like, holy cow, are we missing the boat? Are we doing it wrong? How do we become risky disciples? How do we do this Christianity thing in such a way that Flo from Progressive walks the other way when she sees me walking down the street or sees you walking down the street? Where do we go from here? One of the key things for us to be thinking about is that first question Jesus asks in this piece from Mark. He asked the disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And we've been happy to fight about that for a long time. We usually do like, well, who do they say that I am? Our cultures have been saying, you're just like us. You're the same as us. And so we've gone from Jesus, who probably looked something like this 2,000 years ago, to Orthodox Jesus, still a little dangerous looking, to this one I love. Who do you say that I am? We've been fighting about it. We've been having last month or month before, one of my favorite artists who depicts Jesus in as a person of color with different genders, backgrounds. She still gets lots of hate mail for that. We tend to fight about what Jesus looked like. Does he look like me? Because we, like the disciples, see Jesus through the lens of our own cultures and our own traditions. When Jesus asks the disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" they do it through the lens of their culture, which was expecting, in the heady apocalyptic days of the first century, for Elijah to come back and announce the end of everything. Elijah to come back and announce the kingdom. And so they say, depending on which gospel, you are the new Moses. In Mark's gospel, it's you are Elijah, you are John the Baptist, you are of that prophetic tradition to bring a new law, to bring a new way to the people of God. And that's fine. That's fine. Jesus, the new prophet. Peter sees Jesus through the lens of his own ego and says, "You're the Messiah." Now, he's correct technically, but the why he answers that is not because he came up with some brilliant theological formula here. It's because he wants the Messiah to be the popular picture of the Messiah in that day, which was a Davidic warrior general king on top of a white horse and a sharp flaming sword who would smite all of God's enemies and set up a kingdom of God on earth as it is in heaven. And Peter's going, "And I'm your right-hand man. I get to bask in that glory. I get to be the Messiah's bestie, I guess. Is that the term now? Bestie." And Jesus rebukes him. I still love the King James best. "Get thee behind me, Satan." The popular job description for Messiah is not Jesus' conception. So when he gathers the crowd, he doesn't say, "This is the real job description of the Messiah." He doesn't even use that language. Jesus, in the synoptics, I don't think ever says the word Messiah about himself. When he self-describes, he uses the term Son of Man. Ben Adam, Son of Man, which simply, at its most basic, means the human one, the guy, the dude. Maybe that's where the Coen brothers got that. The dude. Jesus says, "The Son of Man abides." I think we have something there. But the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after three days rise again. That's not the job description Peter wanted. It's not the job description anyone in that crowd wanted. They wanted the victorious warrior general king. Anybody can get themselves crucified. They knew all about suffering. They knew all about rejection. And so Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. And Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan." So he called the crowd together and said to them, "If anyone wants to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the good news will save it." I don't know how they interpreted that back then. I know how we tend to interpret it today. Deny yourself. Deny yourself and follow. Especially on the eve of Lent, we hear deny yourself and we think, I'll give up chocolate. Deny myself. The Reverend Karen Dickey, who's a United Church of Canada pastor out in British Columbia, wrote this. She said, "Denying ourselves, on the surface it sounds like it's got to do with depriving ourselves, not just taking our appetites in hand, but cutting ourselves off from the good things in life." But then she says this, "But this is Jesus who is speaking, who turned water into wine so the party could go on, who himself ate and drank with tax collectors and sinners, who provided food for the multitudes beyond their needs, who set people free to sing and leap and live and love again." So maybe that's not what Jesus meant. Maybe what we are called to deny in ourselves, to be the risky followers that Jesus was talking about, is to deny in ourselves the voice of the ego, that was Peter's, the voice of security, the voice of self-protection, the layers of masks that we wear to keep from having to show our authentic selves in order to protect what Merle Jordan, Barb and my counseling professor, called our TVC, our tender, vulnerable core. It may be denying ourselves means seeing ourselves through the lens of Jesus. Getting the ego wall out, the self-protection wall out, and everything else that keeps us from seeing each other truly and fully. There's a commercial that came out this year from Denmark. I think it's even a bank. I was kind of surprised. And it's ostensibly about how different Danes are only seeing themselves on the surface and are mistrusting each other and hating on each other. People who are new immigrants, people who look a certain way, act a certain way, and we are fighting each other and dismissing each other based on that surface thing, and they devised this little way of helping people get underneath that a bit. So, Bob, could you share this video with us real quick?
It's easy to put people in boxes. There's us, and there's them. The high earners, and those just getting by. Those we trust, and those we try to avoid. There's the new Danes, and those who've always been here. The people from the countryside, and those who've never seen a cow. The religious, and the self-confident. There are those we share something with, and those we don't share anything with.
Velkommen. Jeg kommer til at stille jer nogle spørgsmål i dag. Nogle af dem kan godt være lidt personlige, men jeg håber, I vil svare ærligt på dem. Hvem herinde i rummet var klassens klovn? Hvem er bonusforældre?
And then suddenly, there's us. We who believe in life after death. We who've seen UFOs. And all of us who love to dance. We who've been bullied. And we who've bullied others. And then there's us, the lucky ones who've had sex this past week. We who are broken-hearted. We who are madly in love. We who feel lonely. We who are bisexual, and we who acknowledge the courage of others. We who have found the meaning of life, and we who have saved lives. And then there's all of us who just love Denmark. So maybe there's more that brings us together than we think. TV2 Denmark. All that we share.
TV commercial. Maybe what we're called to deny in ourselves is our ego, our self-protection, the walls that separate us. Up on the mountaintop, there's a cloud that obscures this wild scene with Moses and Elijah and Jesus. And when the cloud goes, they see no one but only Jesus. Only Jesus, not the warrior king, but the lover, the healer, the teacher. Did they then begin to see God through that lens, the disciples? Did they begin to see each other and others through that lens? Remember at the beginning of this sermon, I said that Jesus asked, "Who do you say that I am?" It's one of the most important questions we can ask as disciples. And the answer shapes how we live out our vocation as Christians. And I would suggest that our answer to the question is that Jesus comes among us as the crucified God. The God who enters the fray right at the point of greatest human conflict and contradiction. Here is God not as we expected, but as this Jesus, this vulnerable one, this betrayed one, this one who asks us to live in the places of greatest human conflict and contradiction. This Jesus who asks us to follow him into the fray, denying self, denying ego, denying protection, and walking toward the cross with him. He calls us to let go of the illusion that we have control over our own lives. He wants us to let go of the illusion that we are called to avoid pain and suffering at all costs. He calls us to take up a cross. Now that may seem strange for us, for whom Christianity doesn't entail any real risk at all. But if we do it right, it could. We could risk our complacency about the world, risk the illusion that we are not connected to folk who suffer in faraway places or right in our own neighborhoods and families. We could risk the sublime luxury of long-held grudges. If we do our discipleship right, we could get so involved in ministry that we risk our status in the community, be seen as hanging out with the wrong people. We might risk our pessimism, gaining a hope for God's future and giving up the luxury of sitting on the sidelines and moaning and kvetching about the crappy state of the world. And most terrifying of all, we may risk giving up the illusion of self-control, taking on the realization that it is Jesus to whom we give control. The same Jesus who calls us to realize that it is lives of love and compassion that unite us all to each other and to him. Lives that lived authentically will yield a cross. Now, Peter didn't quite grasp what that was all about. And I have a hard time remembering it. I'm going to repeat a thing I've been saying a lot the last year. And this comes from a theologian that I'm really enjoying named Brad Jerzak. That more and more I realize that the radicality of the Christian gospel is not that we claim that Jesus is somehow like God. We proclaim a far more radical truth that God is somehow like Jesus. Do you see the difference? I grew up in a tradition that was all about teaching us that Jesus is like God. Jesus is Superman. Jesus can do anything. Jesus is about miracles. Jesus is about walking on water. Jesus is about calming the storm. Jesus is about being in control. But if we say that God is like Jesus, that means when we see the way that Jesus is vulnerable to human sin and goes obediently all the way to the cross, when we see Jesus connecting to the marginalized, the disenfranchised, the broken, the hurting, the sick, that means that's what God is like too. I grew up in a tradition that saw God as this incredibly stern father, I don't know why we use that word, who despises us because of our sin, who hates us because of our sin, and holds us over the flames of hell by the merest thread, and his thumb is itchy. But if God is like Jesus, that portrait is horribly, horribly wrong. Ours is the God who goes to the adulterous woman and said, "Who is there to condemn you?" "No one, sir. Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." Who goes to the leper who has to stay outside the walls of the city, who calls from afar, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus comes and touches the untouchable. Who loves the unlovable. God is like that. God is like that. I think this is what the great cloud of unknowing was on the mountain with Moses and Elijah, the author of Torah, the penultimate prophet. The questions we want to ask is, oh, is Jesus the new lawgiver? Is Jesus Elijah come back? Is Jesus a great new prophet? Is Jesus the Davidic warrior king, the Messiah on the white horse and the flaming sword? And the answer is no to all of that. When the cloud was gone, they saw no one but Jesus, just Jesus. The disciples moved from using the Bible and their tradition and their old understanding of God working as the lens to interpret Jesus to suddenly Jesus becoming the lens through which they interpret the Bible and their tradition and their understanding of how God works. Jesus is the lens. God is like Jesus. Will Willimon, former Methodist bishop, says that Jesus does not promise in this scene that by following him things will go better for us. Rather, he promises here that nothing worse will happen to us than happened to him. Thanks, JC. We are to follow him not because it will make us feel better. We are to follow him because he is true. Because he is love, because he is the way to the God who is love. When Jesus rebukes Peter, he says, "Get behind me. Get in step behind me." And this is where we belong, in step behind Jesus. Not fully understanding, only gradually comprehending, but we follow, walking him down a perilous, narrow, risky way, not looking at the rocks and the pitfalls, but only Jesus. A way that leads to a God we would not have met not following him. A God who bids us come to the cross and greets us with the promise of a resurrection. This God who looks like Jesus. Amen.